Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diane Mann.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I am reflecting today on the year, which has been such a turbulent, strange, weird, but equally at times wonderful year.
Inspiring.
And, and the thing that has kept me alive and inspired and engaged has been...
me.
No. I know you like to think these things about yourself, but no. The things, actually, maybe a bit. I'll be a bit kind, otherwise I'm going to get bullied on Instagram by all your fans.
Yeah.
No, the thing that's kept me going has been art. And I was thinking a lot about the work of the artist that we're meeting today, because I actually discovered his work during lockdown.
So.
And it was all through imagery, like predominantly through Instagram, and then also in newspapers, and you know, he's had a lot of coverage in the last kind of 6 months, say, and I really connected with his work, and it's such a weird thing that I've never even actually seen one in real life yet.
Haven't you?
No, I haven't. I know you have, because I've
done
been
like
in
a pilgrimage. I've gone everywhere.
You've seen. You've been to the studio.
Yes.
You've been to the one that's in Old Street.
I saw a gallery exhibition.
And
Goodman Gallery.
Goodman Gallery.
Yes.
And you saw the public one in Old Street, no?
Yes, there's one in Old Street.
And
one on the Line.
The Line,
yep.
Which is in Greenwich.
Yep.
So you've been, you've done
no,
the whole
no, Stratford,
thing.
Like oh,
sorry,
meals,
Stratford.
Yeah.
Sorry, which is the Line, which is in Stratford. And I've been obviously in Margate for most of the year, so I haven't joined you. But I've also experienced his work through your posts and your videos that you send me on WhatsApp.
Yep.
So I feel like I know and understand the work, even though I've never seen it, which is such a weird phenomenon that these times we live in are so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I took a lot of strength from his work, and I feel like art has the possibility to change people's minds and hearts, and it can genuinely change the way that we see and experience the world, and it can have this huge impact on
it can change the conversation and the narrative of society.
Exactly.
Art does that. Art changes culture.
And I think more than ever before, it's such an urgent time to have artists that are saying something so sort of clear and, you know, making artworks that people can actually access and understand through visual language rather than actually like intellectual kind of, you know, like we sometimes were talking about like lectures that we used to listen to in art, and we would just leave not really understanding what anyone just said. And
just
I think
frustrated,
there's something about having a
clarity,
an artwork that's very direct.
Yep.
Anyway, so that's what I've been reminiscing
woo.
And thinking about
Love
the
it.
Last 24 hours.
Amazing.
So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Thomas J. Price.
Thank you. I'm glad you got my name right.
Welcome.
Well, it's Thomas Price some places and Thomas J. Price.
The J's extra.
The J's extra. What does the J stand for?
I like extra. Extra's good.
Yeah, I'm a bit extra. For James.
Ah. Yeah,
it's all family names on my mum's side.
Did you ever get called TJ?
By my younger brother.
Ah.
Still does.
Ah.
And by my niece sometimes.
Ah.
After I've shouted at her a lot.
Oh, no, she's TJ. That's, so she's scared. She calls you TJ.
TJ. Yeah.
She's like, Uncle TJ.
She just calls me Tom.
So how did we find you today? We are in the studio because me and Rob have come to Spiritland in King's Cross to meet you. And I saw you literally about 2 weeks ago, and when I came to your studio and we were like 2 metres apart. And we were there for, I was in your studio for like over 2 hours.
So jealous.
And we were just breaking it down and chatting about everything.
Yeah,
and it just went so quick.
I couldn't believe it when you said it was like, it looks at the clock.
Yeah. Because I think I got there at like 10 and then I left there at 1:45 or something. It's something crazy. And I was like, yeah. What?
We got deep into it.
We did. We went deep. Yeah. We went deep.
Yeah. Where were you, Rob?
I was in Margate.
Yeah.
And I was, I haven't been able to leave very much, sadly. But what happened in the studio visit? Do you enjoy it when people come to your studio?
I do. I love it. I mean, the studio's kind of a mixed-use space, really, because, I spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
I'm a proper studio geek. And it's nice to kind of share that space and the thoughts that happen in that space. Normally, when I'm by myself, with other people, particularly people, like yourself, Russell, who come in and are able to engage with the work on a level which kind of expands my understanding of what I'm doing as well. Because sometimes, you're staring at something or something is, you're so used to shorthand with what you do.
Or with like your assistant or someone new.
Exactly, yes. I work with team and they understand the bits that I'm doing and they're able to, I don't have to explain everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes that verbalizing is really useful. Or, when someone who comes in to see the work spot something else or sort of pinpoints another angle onto it or just shows a level of importance within the their understandings that you think, oh yeah, of course, that bit. So it makes...
I suppose you get used to seeing it from your vision and everybody you work with, but then you want someone from the outside to be like, well, tell me about this. And you think, and that's what you're saying, you might have missed that element of that work and suddenly that can then inspire something else.
Exactly. I mean, it's inspiration that comes from all these different conversations. And it's also just the, on a basic level, the enjoyment of seeing someone engage with the work.
Yeah.
Because a lot, when the works are in public,
I'm
not normally around them, so I won't necessarily see the reactions. In shows, in gallery shows, again, I won't necessarily see other people. But it's nice to actually witness someone sort of getting into the work and then having a conversation about it.
I've always been interested when people get reviews. So if a critic like writes a response to a show, or even, for example, your public sculpture at The Line, that work has had so much response.
Yes.
But it's interesting when you actually then meet a fan almost, like Russell, for example, who's more of a, a person that engages with art and isn't necessarily a critic as such. The difference between that, because is there a difference between that for you?
There's a difference if someone likes a work and doesn't like a work and how they engage with you on that basis. The work is there to be looked at, to be critiqued, to be dissected, to be talked about, to stimulate other conversation. So it's,
do you find that vulnerable though, or do you,
absolutely.
And are you incredibly sensitive to, once the work's out there, I mean, obviously you have faith in your own work, but are you sensitive to critique?
I'm certainly not invulnerable to it, but it's part of the deal that I think artists often make. I certainly have made this deal that if I'm going to put work out into the public realm particularly, or into the public generally speaking, then of course everyone has the right to talk about it and has the right to say whatever their opinion is. Now, I also have the right to either ignore or take on board what they're saying based on where they're coming from and what I think their intentions are and what they say. And I've had really interesting, talked about Instagram before. I try not to get involved in Instagram, comment section debates because
leave the comments on, though.
I think it's important to leave the comments on. Yeah. I know, there are other artists who turn their comments off.
I know.
And that's their decision. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if I'm talking about engaging with certain elements, at the moment, as the platform is, it's a space which it can be a little bit edgy, but...
It's a public forum, isn't it?
Forum.
Yeah.
And so I'm not trying to, micromanage the image of me or of the work.
Yeah.
It's about really seeing what people think about this work.
But also for people who don't know your work yet, I mean, I'm sure many people will have actually seen it, but they might not even know your name, for example, yet. But if they've seen your work reaching out, that work had so much kind of, there's been so many people photographing it but you're actually making work that's in the public realm. So you're making public sculptures. And this one is a 9-foot bronze?
Yeah, so it's a 9-foot bronze figure of an imagined woman, quite a young woman. She's in black bronze, casual clothing. Yeah. And she's just sort of, I would say, rather tenderly holding a mobile device and looking down to it. And there's an ambiguity to the expression. There's a sort of a classical nod to the stance, but it's very much a contemporary pose that everyone takes up when looking at these devices, which so much of our lives are sort of
consumed
by, but also lived through. Yeah. And these are things that connect us to the world, but also can isolate us from the world.
Yes.
And they harness so much of our dreams and desires and anxieties and happiness. And, you know, it's about communication, but it's about understanding oneself and about also projecting oneself into the other. So essentially, you know, I've talked about them as being these sort of experiments in empathy. And so it's about really recognizing the commonality in other people, regardless of what they look like. You know, like, you know, my work is often talked about in terms of race, and I, you know, because the people I've sculpted are often from African Caribbean backgrounds, heritage, like myself. And that was almost like a barrier in the initial stages of people getting into the works and understanding them as human beings, as opposed to representations of a part of society.
Yes.
Right. And my stance has always been that these are people. These are emotional states. These are complex internal landscapes, internal world and worlds, which we all have. So what do you see when you look at this object, when you look at this representation of a person? And so, you know, they're not portraits, you know, if they are, they're psychological portraits, but they're a psychological portrait perhaps of the person who's looking at the work. So the person brings, you know, the viewer brings themselves to
they activate the work for you.
Exactly.
So your work needs an audience.
I think, it's funny because the work needs the audience, but the sculptures themselves, the figures, they don't acknowledge the existence of an audience. They don't try to meet the eye of the viewer. No. They don't try to
engage
with the viewer.
They're not asking them for any attention.
Exactly, they're self-contained.
But yet the scale of them draws so much attention. The fact that you come across this...
They're commanding,
woman,
aren't they?
They're commanding. She's 9 foot, but she's not involved in you. She's looking at her phone, and you've tired it reaching out. Is she reaching out to someone? Is someone reaching out to her?
Absolutely.
But as a bystander coming across this, you're like... is so engaged and you want to know, and she's got like a pair of Nike trainers and she has this really kind of casual universality that is based on the authentic lived experience of someone.
But also if you walk down the street now and you see everybody walking down the street, I'd say 95% of people have the phone or whatever device they have connected to their hand so much that it's almost like an extension of our being now.
Yeah.
And that really struck me.
You've also mastered the ability to walk without actually looking at the floor.
Yes, I know.
and know the horizon and you're not going to fall over.
And avoid each other. Yeah. I always get baffled by that.
Yeah.
And then when you occasionally see people bump into each other, they get so shocked.
Yeah.
You know, that, like, how dare you? You know, but it's like you're the one walking with your phone in your hand.
Yeah.
But it is funny how they've become this kind of extension, like a futuristic kind of sci-fi thing.
I've seen people who wait, you know, like you're waiting for someone to turn up. Maybe that doesn't happen during COVID, but and people pull their phone out immediately. Mm.
Well, it used to be, yeah, absolutely. But I think it used to be, I used to have a cigarette when I was a kid. Mm. So I'd be waiting for a train or a bus. Mm. If I had a cigarette, I wasn't on my own.
Yeah.
But if I didn't have a prop, it's a prop. If you don't have something to focus on, you felt more lonely.
It's also less embarrassing or something because you're sort of stood there on your own awkwardly and people are like, why are they on?
See, I'm that awkward person. I refuse to pull my phone out so that
I
force myself to be in that moment and feel those anxious moments.
Really?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's brave and kind of cool.
A bit weird, I guess.
It's not what it is.
No, that's
weird.
Interesting.
I think that's like...
But maybe that's because you're an artist as well. You're trying to, like, you sort of look at the world differently.
I think when you notice something...
Yeah.
Well, I certainly... When I notice something in the works that I make... maybe it's like it's a statement I say, like, you know, for example, it was, well, these, because I started making, there were nude figures, initially very small scale nude figures. And I said, well, they'll never have clothing. Because for me, that would contextualize them too much in a social...
Mm-hmm. What, then you were like, going forwards, I'm never going to make sculpture with clothing.
But
right?
They're never going to have, the clothing gets in the way of understanding these individuals as these sort of psychological landscapes, these sort of, identities. And
it's
then I thought,
conceptual.
Why?
It's quite conceptual because it's the interior, even though it's your concept, because it's the interior of these people, but it's actually the exterior we're seeing, but it's the conceptual journey for these for you.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, my work is often mistaken for the thing it sort of critiques, which is figurative sculpture. You know, like for me, these are generated by inquiry into that, those psychological spaces that we all manifest, we all have, we kind of live in, and how those psychological sort of realms sort of kind of are next to one another when we're in proximity. And so it's always been this sort of internal which has generated the external of these sculptures. So, you know, I had to learn how to sculpt the figure in order to communicate in the way that I felt was going to be most effective for trying to engage with the ideas that I was trying to talk about. And so people sort of took me to be a figurative sculptor, and the idea of the portrait, you know, these must be of someone, and the very fact is that I'm making these imagined people, these sort of amalgams, in order to critique portraiture itself, this value system that we all buy into, mm. you know, to some degree. The expectation is that these are of a particular person, and if they're in bronze and they're outdoors, then it's got to be of someone who is important.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying, you know, well, where is the importance, you know, and who do you see? And so it's
you're challenging the hierarchy
exactly,
of public art, of public sculpture.
Yeah. An expectation that we all have, so that all it makes us kind of complicit in the maintenance of that system.
Well, it's just a learned belief system, isn't it? It's just a learned, like, that's on a plinth, mm. that's important. And if that's in the public domain, that has to be of someone.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Obviously, that's someone. And you're challenging that, saying it's not. This is everyone. Yeah. Potentially, and everyone has that opportunity.
Yeah. And I think that's why sometimes people can get annoyed by the, particularly the large sculptures I make.
Do they get annoyed?
Yeah.
Because they want it, they need it to be
they
someone.
Need it to be of the thing within the system, within the line of understanding which they have sort of, they have faith in.
Yeah.
You know, which they have resolved in their minds. You know, you don't want another thing which, now I've got to think about this. You know, you know, which I love. I love the fact that you can pull people out of their comfort zone.
Exactly.
Through something which is should be innocuous, should be, you know, there's a person. I wonder. And yet it's like, well, why is she in casual clothing?
But does it have something to do with the fact that they're black people, that people are challenged more? Because this sculpture of this woman is one of three, am I correct?
I believe so, yeah.
Statues of black women in the country.
It's the first one made by a black person.
And that's just insane.
Yeah, I didn't know. Someone told me that, and I was like, really? I mean, in terms of public sculpture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And so I guess with the rarity, you know, if you want to call it that, there is a higher level expectation, or there's more at stake per piece,
mm-hmm.
you know? Okay, so why this piece then?
So it's got to mean more.
It's got to mean more, and it's got to be...
Yeah.
And for me, they mean a lot.
Yeah.
But it's about resisting the expectation, resisting the demands that society places on black people particularly, to, you know, this performative element. You must smile, you know, don't seem threatening. Smile, stand up straight, you know. It's all these things which everyone gets, no matter what race you consider yourself to be.
Yeah.
Everyone is under the same sort of social
contracts.
Exact, social contracts. And I'm using, I guess, my experience... as a kind of microcosm to talk about how we understand one another and how we feel within ourselves, and is that understood by other people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like, how do we connect to one another, basically? Mm-hmm. You know, on a really fundamental level,
yeah.
is how do we connect to each other, and where do those failings sneak in?
Yeah.
And it's these works for me give people a moment to confront those mechanisms of understanding, you know, to have a become slightly aware of maybe the schema, you know, all the principles which form our attitudes towards the world around us.
Mm.
And so, you know, the figurative works that I do, because I do, you know, the works come from kind of video works, much more abstract looking things.
Mm.
But these sort of conceptual works, these figures are incredibly conceptual works for me, which are, yeah, opportunities for us to sort of take note. Have a pause and consider the other as ourselves.
But they're based on types, parentheses,
yeah.
media types.
Mm.
So the clothing you've chosen is of a type. And I think I remember you telling me that there was a commission you had, and it was of a young man or a young woman.
Mm.
And then this was during the riots, and suddenly something happened. And at the last minute, they were like, we can't have this because it looks
yeah.
like...
I mean, it really went to, you know, it went to exemplify exactly everything I was trying to push against.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was just after the, I don't know what we called it. We called it, it wasn't the London riots. It was the, you know, the national riots we had, was it 2012?
Yeah.
Which the media loved.
It started in Tottenham, didn't
it? Started in Tottenham and, you know, spread across the country to mm-hmm. different degrees. And the media was saying, you know, it's Blackberry's causing all this, and, you know, it's if you looked at the media coverage, they clearly were trying to weight the visuals in black and brown people causing trouble, and then at the end there were a lot of sort of younger middle class white people with brooms going, we just don't understand what's happening, but we just want to clear it up. And that total skewing of the visual narrative, this dog whistle sort of element, was for me absolutely clear, was never really confronted. Because obviously, if you look at the court reports, it was the people who were engaged in the so-called rioting who were arrested were across the board. You know, they didn't come from one group. It wasn't staggered. But yeah, I was commissioned. Actually, one of the first commissions I had was to create a work for an institution that I won't name, to create work that young people could see themselves in and feel inspired by. Yeah. And I created what now has become the work called Network, which is this is a 3-foot bronze figure and also a 9-foot bronze figure, the ones in Old Street. And the original commission was for the 3-foot figure. And to, I'll shorten the story, but basically at the very last minute, I was told that I got an email before the work was going to go to the foundry saying that I'm afraid we cannot accept the work as it is.
Wow.
And no,
and it wasn't nude. This was dressed.
He's wearing a body warmer, trousers, you know, some sort of generic trainers, but looking at what looks like a mobile device.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first mobile phone I sculpted was back in 2008, I think, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it a Nokia?
It was.
Was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was
they
a Nokia.
Were playing
Snake. Yeah, I miss Nokia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, so when I got this email saying we can't accept the work, initially my mind went through, like, there must be some sort of practical reason.
Yeah.
And I found out later via a contact from the institution that it was because... there was a worry that the media would consider this figure to be representation of a rioter, of someone who was engaged in the in the rioting, and you know they said it was because
it was had a
mobile phone
and the BlackBerry Messenger and all that
stuff,
right?
And you know, I couldn't help but think this is nonsense. Like,
was it upsetting?
Yeah, it was really because the very people who have purported to say we understand your work, they approach me, we understand your work, we see what it does, we want it to have this positive impact, and then they're sort of trying to protect the people represented from an image of themselves, and they're creating the very stigma, the very negative associations that they're saying they're trying to, you know, deal with. And it's just like, so the people who mean well are compounding an issue that is very serious and has a significant impact on people's lived lives.
Yes.
You know, experiences.
Lived experience, yeah.
It was, to be honest, it was really worrying and disturbing that this could happen.
I mean, it's actually kind of outrageous. It's outrageous because it's also... If it's a cultural institution, surely they should be intelligent enough to understand that the reason they invited you in the first place, you know. And if you're creating culture, then that's there to reflect on society and
challenge.
Impact society and challenge.
Yeah.
And the mere fact that your work is coming from this, which I consider to be an incredible generous place, to make an artwork that's not just, not that it's bad to do that, because obviously people do make sculptures of important people from history, and there's a whole other discussion, but the whole conceptual approach you have is to disrupt people's daily experience, to look at that sculpture and then question why it's not some, you know, a known figure.
Absolutely.
And why it is actually a portrait of the person viewing. Like, that's a really generous act as an artist. So it's ludicrous that they would then pull the plug. I mean, it's actually outrageous.
Mm. Well, it's the fear. I think it's the fear that washed over them. That they would get caught up in this media storm and it would be detrimental to what they were doing or as an institution. But it's the fact that then sort of blinkered them to the very fact that they were contributing to this thing, you know, to part of this, you know, what I would call institutional racism.
Yeah, well, they're upholding it, actually.
Absolutely.
And that's the really interesting thing that I think is starting, hopefully, to shift within the last, I don't know, number of months, really.
Mm.
But I think it's going to take, you know, a few more years for it to actually be, you know, to start changing in these institutions. But there's definitely a thing now where people are having to reevaluate, aren't they?
Yeah.
Whereas before, I think there has been so much of institutions just upholding all of that institutional racism.
I mean, in all honesty, I hope it continues. I hope the awareness creates structural change which then kind of brings in people who are able to maintain the sort of the attitude and the understandings which can lead to progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not talking slightly general terms here, but it applies to so many different institutions, different places.
Yeah. Well, all levels of culture.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
But the part of me that's seen bits of this before is a bit kind of like
jaded
and tired. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was just like, just cautious because you know, if you take people's word like, okay, this is going to be fine. Don't, hey, we're going to get some people in. It's fine. We want to speak to you. It's good. But that can change. You know, I think one of the most powerful and also the most dangerous things is, you know, this idea of the incremental. And things sort of just shift just slightly, ever so slightly. You don't even realise. And then...
Backwards. You realize, yeah.
But, you know, you can also use it for positive change forwards, you know. Mm-hmm. Just keep moving. Keep, you know, you just don't stop. Like, you know, I've talked about being exhausted, but it's... But I'm also really excited and motivated.
You're fired up.
I am. I'm trying to wave my arms.
I feel like this year a lot's happened, and you've been very vocal in a lot of conversations about public art.
Mm. Yeah,
and well, I think that's also really fired you up, and also brought a lot of attention onto you.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's you know, 2020 has been such an insane year so far. We're almost out of it. I always felt that there was definitely a learning experience in here, no matter what happened before all the conversations I got involved with. I think it's just been a culmination of, as an artist, sort of maturing, you know, finding more understanding in my voice and what I want to say, and there being the circumstances to engage directly in the debates which need to be had. And so there's the public face of what I've been doing, which is, you know, the public realm work. There's also the sort of the more gallery based stuff where, you know, for many years I've been talking to a gallery audience about similar things, you know, in terms of the humanistic, but also the racial elements of the work and the art world.
Yeah. You know?
So it's been a really...
The impact is different in a gallery space and in the public realm.
Absolutely.
With your artwork, isn't it? Yeah. It's a different audience that are receiving it.
Yeah, and I really hope that there'll be a sort of a crossover that happens more. Like, you know, now that, you know, public sculptures are very much in the public consciousness.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas before, I think for many years, they were backdrop.
Mm.
They were the things that we just, you know, just took for granted because we saw them all the time. The decoration, street furniture kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But now the potency and the way that in which they inform society has been recognised and understood by people, you know, it has put a focus on my work, because for part of my practice, I've been talking about that for about, you know, almost 20 years, which is who do we look up to? Literally, who do we look up to? You know, and you know, we talked about reaching out. Well, you know, she is reaching out. She's not looking down. She's reaching out. And so there's, you know, she's on the ground. She's not on a plinth.
Yeah.
You know,
I love that. Yeah.
You know, and I absolutely love plinths and how you can play with the idea of status via the plinth. But for me, these large bronze, you know, monumentally, you know, kind of material kind of works, they need to be on the ground sometimes to amongst us, to really engage with us directly and to make us connect to them.
Mm.
And it's interesting because there's other artists in the past year who have also across the world been making public sculptures. So if you think in England, actually, in Parliament Square, you've had Gillian Waring who did the suffragette sculpture, which was on a plinth and had a text actually on the plinth. But the reason that kind of worked was because it was in the context of other sculptures.
Yep.
And she was the first female artist to make a sculpture in Parliament Square and of a woman as well. It's the first sculpture that was of a woman. So
there's
that was
images
very
on that plinth as
significant,
well of everyday women now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was quite interesting. And then if you think of Kehinde Wiley's sculpture that was originally in Times Square and then moved and into... where is it?
Washington.
Yeah. And it's part of that whole Confederate kind of sculpture, you know, and it's on a plinth, but then it becomes part of that whole history and discourse. Like it's beginning to happen where you're getting different voices kind of highlighting,
I think the thing that really drew me to the monumental sort of look, you know, stylings, was this idea of the grand and the conquering. And all the, you know, incredibly important, so shoulders back, head up, and the strident sort of attitude that's projected and emanates from these figures. Well, my figures sort of, they look at their phone, they slump a little bit, they might not be the most idealistic proportions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's about rejecting that whole notion of superiority. Like, is that whole idea of buying into a system which creates and maintains a hierarchy of, like, value within people. So... Because it doesn't matter who is the conquering hero, ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, it's good to remind us that this is who we normally see.
And they're always staring out, looking at eternity. Yeah. It's like they don't...
Yeah.
And your characters, your figures are...
They're in their heads.
Yeah.
You know, for me, they're in their heads. And it's about drawing the viewer into those heads. And it's not about sort of recreating or mimicking, you know, these conquering heroes. It's about finding the heroic within the everyday.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the distinction between what I do and what monumental sculpture has been doing or is.
But it's so interesting because when you puff up your chest, you know, like a lot of these public sculptures have been for a
we're all doing it.
It almost shuts people out.
Yeah.
There's something about that superiority and the heroic and that it almost pushes people away.
Yeah.
Whereas what you're doing is bringing people in.
Yep.
So that empathy thing and that the idea of like trying to connect the, you know, like the
universality of
it's really,
I always
really
talk about
powerful.
The push-pull. So, like, when I started with very small sculptures, which were, like, again, I consider monumental in terms of their detailing and the size of them was about creating the size of their density, which sort of sucked the viewers into them. And, you know, there'd be, like, one small head on a huge wall with a spotlight on it.
Which Russell's, by the way, obsessed with. He's been texting me pictures, and he's completely obsessed with your small sculptures. But there is a weight to them, and, like, a powerful energy resonating from them.
Isn't that the play with the scale? Because when we first met, I remember I saw Rom Ewart's My Dead Dad, and I shared this with you at the Saatchi Gallery, and it's a figure of his dad, but it's scaled down one-third the size.
Yep.
But it's all proportionally within that scale, perfect. And I remember just being so moved and captivated by it, because if it had been like real scale, I wouldn't have been as connected to it.
It's uncanny, isn't it?
I think you're like, okay, I get what it is. But there's something about the playing of scale, and that is so important to your work.
Yep.
Why do you think it has that? Because it allows for a different experience, and it makes people notice it more if you play around with the scale.
I think it's exactly what you just said, really. It makes people think about it. So instead of just being like, you know, our unconscious minds go, right, recognise that, move on.
Right.
You know, with Newark's work, I think, his played really with the idea of perspective or distance, because it was so, you know, the hyper-realism of that work made you almost question where you stood in relation to that object. So are you looking at an image of this thing? Because how can it be that small? It looks perfect. And so, you know, I love that about that work and the optics it kind of plays with in terms of, you know, distance. With mine, they're very much trying to be like these objects. So it's like they are of sculpture. These are artworks about sculpture, about statues. In
sculptures
many ways.
That are about statues.
And
which is quite meta.
And you know, I wanted people to look at to consider who is represented here, who would I normally see in this kind of style, and then have to sort of work out their relationship, you know, in terms of how they felt, you know, in terms of scale compared to these objects.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the early works, they had lots of detail, which would try to pull the draw the viewer in to kind of start getting like face to face with these little things.
Yeah.
Oh.
And so, you know, shift the viewer, you know, to control the viewer's bodies, basically. And their feeling of either feeling, you know, comfortable or powerful in these sort of moments of confrontation with another, you know, with a person or with a representation of a person.
Mm.
So, I mean, I'm talking a lot here, but, you know, I was playing a lot with, in terms of material, you know, like, so instead of using marble, I was using plaster with a bit of marble dust in it, maybe, and MDF shells with one screw in. Then I was using, you know, bronze, but then I would patina it in a way that looked a bit more plasticky. And scale has, you know, has always been that incredibly important element in terms of creating the dynamic with the viewer, which kind of influences their entry point and to the work, to the understanding of the work, and then sort of, you know, augments the experience of that viewing or that kind of relationship with the work, that conversation, internal conversation with the work.
Mm-hmm.
I feel I'm talking a lot of
No, you're not. So as an artist now you're having more attention and these works are out in the public realm and they're being discussed.
Mm.
What does that feel like? Is that a pressure now, or is that a kind of catalyst for more exciting ideas?
I feel really charged up by it and very grateful that, you know, I kept going, basically. Because there's
a
lot
of. Did you feel like giving up?
I didn't feel like giving up, but I did feel like, you know, there's so many ways that, you know, ideas come into, you know, as an artist, any kind of creative, there's so many ideas and so many different ways to execute these ideas and different avenues to go down. And I really, you know, I think since I was young, had an affinity with the kind of thing I'm doing now. And instead of getting drawn into other ways of presenting work to try and kind of get more attention, I really stuck to what felt genuine to me. And I'm, you know, it's quite a surreal experience now that there's lots of other people on the same page going, oh, yeah, of course, that. And then telling me about it. I'm like, oh, right, yeah. Well, let's continue this conversation. This is great. In terms of the attention that's kind of come to the work now, I feel it's amazing. It's like, I feel that there's a lot more that can be done. Mm. I feel there are, you know, I would love to get the work out there in front of more people.
Where's the dream place to have your work publicly? You know, you're in Yorkshire Sculpture Park. Yeah, we're on the line. Yeah. You're at Old Street Roundabout. Mm. I'm sure that they're great places, but you've also got work up in Canada.
It's seeing the work internationally, which has been,
because America's been incredibly rewarding for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, the conversation in America, particularly around, you know, in society and around racial politics, identity politics, and history, and you know, kind of taking ownership of their history and looking at the realities of what have happened, mm-hmm. as opposed to the textbook version of what's happened, is really inspiring. I hope that they continue and to challenge themselves and live with that uncomfortableness until things are
out there.
And we have to do it here as well. Yeah. So,
Feel like here we try and let ourselves off a bit, like we're not like America?
Well, we say that, don't we? So, we're not like America. And then we dismiss it, and that should be enough. So we're not like America. So next question: what about the weather?
Yeah.
And that's where we kind of want to exist. But there are institutions and different scales who are wanting to now,
be uncomfortable.
Be uncomfortable. And I've always said, like, there seems to be this expectation, particularly in white society, that you shouldn't be uncomfortable. Yeah. I'm like, dude, I've been uncomfortable for so many years. Yeah. Like, the questions I get, the spaces I go where I'm, like, the only one, inverted commas, you learn to deal with being uncomfortable as a reality. And I think, that's how we grow.
You go, this is my lot, this is what I've got to deal with.
Like, but even like making work, like if you just make work where you feel comfortable, then you stagnate. Cool. Yes. So you've got to push, in everything. And I think we have to do that in terms of our character and in terms of how we live our lives. Mm. You've got to be uncomfortable.
But also being an artist is quite an uncomfortable sort of journey anyway. And I was thinking just now about certain artists that I love the most, and they are almost like long distance runners. Yeah, there's some kind of like, it's like the whole of your life you're just running, and then
it's a marathon, not a sprint, isn't it?
Yeah, but it is really pretty exhausting, to be honest.
It's relentless.
Yeah, it's it is relentless, and I love it.
Yeah, good.
I think that's what I really drew me to it, is that it doesn't end until you do, and then maybe someone else picks it up and runs with it.
Well, art history-wise, is that exactly. Yeah, someone takes your thing and then they go.
And they go with it, and the story continues, and hopefully the ideas get to, live again in different contexts and inform other people just be enjoyed and sort of be of value throughout time. But
I think what your work is doing is incredibly valuable and definitely pushing the narrative and the conversation on. Absolutely.
What do you feel about... I heard Steve McQueen the other day talking about his new TV series that he's just made.
Small Axe.
Yes, exactly. And he was talking about the idea of them being... Well, the journalist was talking about them being sort of black British stories. And Steve said, no, they're British stories. So how do you feel as being a British artist?
Yeah.
Because now your work's obviously being shown in Vancouver and in America and in Canada and whatever. Yeah. How do you feel about the Britishness within your work?
I feel very British. I mean, whether or not other people have considered me British is another matter.
Right.
I feel British, but I think sometimes what British means is been narrowed down by other people. I remember someone asking me, where am I from? And I said, I'm from London. I go, no, but where are you really from? I was born in Camberwell. Like, no, where are you really from? I got down to a street until I went, well, my dad's Jamaican. I went, ah, that's it, you're Jamaican. And, it's sort of...
palatable for them.
That's a question that is, most people who are not identified initially as, you know, the understood idea of British will recognise that little conversation, that interaction. Mm-hmm. So I feel British, but that's because my understanding of what British means is a bit more expansive, perhaps. You know, mm-hmm. you know, it's when we look at, for example, like the Windrush. You know, I'm doing the Windrush Commission in Hackney.
Yes,
this is an incredible opportunity to really kind of create a visual representation which creates, yeah, this sort of understanding within the fabric of society. You know,
but you're talking to the community around there as well.
Yeah, so I'll be talking to the community, and we'll be, you know, doing photographs, and interviews, and scans, and all sorts of things to try and build a picture of what it means to be from Windrush, you know, connected to the Windrush, mm-hmm. And living in the UK and being British, or being whatever they consider themselves to be, you know, mm-hmm. but being accepted for that, but being acknowledged as part of British society, and not having to explain where you're from. Where am I from? Well, look over there, because there's some big statues that look a bit like me.
Yeah. You know?
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it won't work, maybe it will work, I don't know. But for me, it's about creating a visual understanding of what British could look like.
Right.
You know, you don't have to be wearing the British, you know, athletic vest or something. Or, yeah. You know, it's about all sorts of parts of society, you know, recognising the complexity and the beauty of the variety that we have here. And that has been here for so long.
Yes.
It hasn't just turned up.
No.
It's been here for so long, building what we understand as Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Yeah, you know, contributed to the whole of culture and changing society.
Yeah.
Yeah, constantly. Yeah.
Like, not just music, you know, but everything. Yeah, and it's about just... There is an ordinary, you know, inverted commas, looking person. It looks like me, you know, and that's British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, it's such a simple thing. And yet I said that and I'm like, oh, God, yeah, okay. You know, it's just to not to have to explain oneself at every party you go to, you know?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Well, I think you said some inspiring things about where some kids have gone past your work and gone like, oh, look, Mummy, that looks like me.
Yeah.
And that is so, and the fact that is rare is so offensive in some ways that art has a responsibility to represent diversity in the world. And unless you see yourself in art, sometimes
but
you don't.
But also it's opportunity as well. And I was going to ask you about that, because if you think now, you know, you're getting really well known, you've got giant public sculptures, you know, there, and they're going to be there forever, hopefully.
Yeah.
So, but there's this idea of like you as a kid, say, when you were beginning to make and be creative, how do you think you've been able to get to where you are now? Like, is it about, you know, is it because you had opportunities? Because I feel like when need to make more opportunities for all kinds of artists as well?
That's a really good question and a very tricky one to answer.
Yeah.
I think there was quite a lot of luck. I think I've been incredibly lucky in terms of having support around me. So I, you know, I have to be a bit of a cliche here and go, my mother is an absolutely amazing woman who supported any crazy idea I had about what I wanted to be.
That was my mum.
Or,
and my mum as well, actually, yeah.
So I think there's a commonality then, you know.
Yeah.
I think if you have someone who you look up to and who you love.
Champions enthusiasm.
Exactly, and embraces that and helps you expand that and harness that and employ it just into your life, you know, you'll find your thing. Like, I didn't always want to be an artist, but you'll find you a thing.
What was you before you wanted to be an artist?
I want to be so many different things. I just wanted to try and be good at something. I wanted to be a physiotherapist at one point.
Did you?
Yeah.
Really? So sport, was sport a kind
of thing? I loved sport, yeah. I loved the training element. I loved the... perhaps the results-based kind of side of it, but also that trying to incrementally, trying to get better at something. And I think when I first got into art properly, I was thinking about it as a thing that could be, you know, looked at by other people, not just myself.
Yeah.
It was, I took on an attitude of like sports, you know, like if you just keep training, you know, keep doing it, keep pushing it.
And competitiveness with yourself and your peers?
I'm certainly competitive with myself, which is the worst thing, because it means that you try and leave the studio and then you go back in. And then you go leave the studio again. And you go, just went back in. Because, you know, if I leave the studio, I don't feel absolutely broken. I feel like I've cheated myself, which is the most ridiculous thing ever.
Well, I guess that's like playing a match then. There's the sport element of it. Yeah. You kind of have to break your body down and exhausted.
I'm just thinking about competitive with other people. I think, you know, sometimes you're so inspired by other works you see, perhaps, or... when you just see the work ethic, you know, when I think about work ethic or just absolute quality of work, I think of like Kerry James Marshall or someone like that. Yeah. I just think that is an example of a kind of artist that just doesn't stop, and it is what they do, and there's that rigor to what they do. And I want to make sure that if people are going to spend their time or their money looking at something I've done, it contains that rigor and all that energy that I expend into it, so that, you know, that contract that we talked about before, that social contact contract is also there in a more kind of like intimate kind of way.
You don't want anyone to feel cheated by your work. You want it to be
authentic. I'm just thinking that's quite a weird way of thinking about
it. It's not, though, because that means it strives for you to always be the best.
But it's also about honesty, I guess, isn't it? And this idea of the truth, at least your truth and your perspective that you're then putting out into the world. It's really important, actually. And that's also why it resonates.
I've always kind of wanted to make sure that I ask myself those difficult questions and listen to the answer and then distill that answer or that genuine line of inquiry into the works. And that's why the works speak to one another, and people often ask me, what's your favorite work? I don't have one, because every time I do something that I think is really good within a particular work, it exposes something else that I feel needs to be explored further. And so it just bounces me around these different pieces of work,
constantly propelling itself
forward. It's like self-perpetuating,
noticing something new in another piece,
or the approach to the piece. So, you know, for example, when I said, like, of course, you know, these works need to be nude in order to kind of retain their sort of the genuine sense of who they are within society without being kind of, you know,
positioned
via their clothing, that statement had to be challenged by myself. I was like, well, why do I think that? You know, why do I really think? And what would happen then if I didn't? And that led to this whole new line of work where I did look at clothing, and I looked at the tradition of drapery and how clothing is being used, in particularly in public sculpture, or a way to kind of show affluence and position, and critique it via the things that I understand now. And that led to the first piece I did called New Drape, which was a guy in, you know, trainers and jeans, just with a jumper with his hands in his pockets. You know, this thing that you're not supposed to do. And, you know, in the US and other countries, you can get shot for. You know, these very subtle... very subtle sort of
political
things, the gestures, these tiny gestures that I think for a lot of people it means nothing. It's like, well, of course you put your hands in your pockets, but, you know, you do that, if you look a certain way and you do that, it's a whole different game.
Wow.
You know, so it's, yeah, there's a lot to the kind of conceptual element to why figurative work, that keeps me in it. You know, I'm kind of expanding into doing more of what I began with, which was like abstract looking works which deal with the kind of the way that we look at things or the way that we hear things or process things, but in terms of connecting to an audience, there's a directness and a kind of efficiency with the figuration which I think is which is quite important at the moment. So that's what I'm pushing.
And actually, that word rigor that you were using to describe Kerry James Marshall is why I think your work is really good, because I think you have got, not good as in, not really the best word to use probably, but you know,
nice.
Effective. No, effective. Why your work is actually impacting people's lives is because it does have that rigor and that intention that is very critical. You know what I mean? And you seem to have I've never met you before, but, you know, just from spending this hour with you, you've got a very clear way of communicating and understanding what it is your purpose is in the work, you know? And I think that's actually, it's going to be its strength going forwards too.
I hope so. I just think, yeah, I just want to kind of stay on top of it and not ease up and, you know, take anything for granted, basically. I think that's what all the good artists that I sort of enjoy, you know, looking at their work, they don't kind of ease back.
Julia Payton-Jones we interviewed, and she said that artists, her advice was, don't believe your own press release.
Totally.
So you just got to stay in your head and be on that prize. Yeah. So these characters, the figures are all imagined, we talked about. So where do you get these characters from? Are you someone that sits on a bus and watches people? Do you work from photography? Are you into movies and TV and theatre? Are all these things, like the theatricality of life, do you just take that all in, or do you have a process as well?
All of that. It's changed over time. Yeah. And I still, on the way here in the cab, I was actually looking at people through the window and catching them in their sort of, I call them, those honest moments, those sort of off-guard moments where you're not presenting anything, you're not trying to come across anyway.
Or when the selfie comes up on your phone, and you've got it the wrong way around.
I used one of those as my profile picture once, because it was like a nice, I was just smiling, I think I was talking to someone, and it was like a great picture.
Yeah, there was actually an amazing video I told Russ, and we interviewed Tukwase Dyson for the podcast, and she posted this thing of her Zoom where she's trying to set up the Zoom for a chat, and she wasn't sure how to do it. Yeah. And you see this whole sort of 2-minute section of her moving around. It's so beautiful, though. It's a really great portrait of her.
It's those genuine moments. Those genuine moments where you might not be smiling because you don't have to smile. You understand that you may be happy So I like those moments of absorption that people have. Until they catch me looking at them, and then it's a bit awkward. But I also do look at movies and magazines. But when I'm doing that, I'm looking more at how people are presented,
like dressed or hair or
dressed, the hair, the styling, but also the script, also the positioning, the kind of positioning within a screenplay, the positioning within an editorial. Who are these people supposed to be? What are they representing?
And what are they projecting?
Yeah. How are they being used to project a particular thing? And so sometimes it's, what was it? God, I'm quite old now. Back in like 2001.
You're 39. Yeah,
yeah, I'm young.
I'm the oldest in here. I'm 40.
Yeah, old
now.
Hag.
We're all young.
Yeah, we are.
But I would look at, the press coverage, the written, the copy for these press things, and again, I would look at the descriptors used and when they were used, and I couldn't help but kind of gravitate towards when the word black was used. And black was often used, and I haven't gone through and checked now, so it might be different, but I doubt it, was used only like in a negative context. I'm a bit of a geek, so you look at like Tolkien and something like that, and black is bad, basically. So we kind of grow up on that. But, in the press, when they're describing a individual, they would make a point of noting their perceived race if it was a sort of a negative story, and yet if it was something like a triumph for the country or something that's been achieved,
then
it
British.
Would be British.
Yeah,
and I even as a younger person, I would see that and you feel that resonates within you, and that creates this sort of this feeling of, you either go with that, so you have to be good, and this way of internalizing this sort of negative trope, which is connected to the very part of your being which you cannot remove yourself from, and then that idea of like, well, why should you, like, why is it being used in this manner? And I think that sort of was always, that awareness was always there with my work. So even when I talk about us creating these works, they're about humanity, about how we all feel, about how we connect to one another, how we experience the same things. Yes, but I talked about microcosm before. I was trying to use the truth of my experience and the awareness of that experience to try and engage with viewers, other people, about what is the truth about your experience, and do you recognize this with me?
Right.
And I think that sort of dynamic is still present in my work and in the process in which I work. I can't remember what we're talking about now. I'm just going off on a... But, it's trying to retain that authenticity and one's truth, and connect that to other people's lived experiences. So not to, I've never wanted to say this work is about being black. Like, reaching out is not, for me, about being black. It's not about being a woman. It's about
existing,
living in this world, and the things that are brought to that.
The projections that projections. Are on you.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's really interesting in the time that we've been doing talk art, and even being your friend, Russ, because Russ is obviously an actor, and when you're talking about the influence of film and TV and scripts and things like that in your work, and, yeah. But it's interesting the kind of the idea of construction of the self and how when you do like a fashion shoot, say now, you can often come across a certain way in a photo that looks amazing and really appealing, but I often look at it and I'm like, that's not actually the Russ that I know, if that makes sense. But it's a character he's playing. So even... Yeah. No, I don't mean that. I don't mean
like
that.
A bag of
shit.
I'm like, that can't be Russ. Have they been photoshopping
that? How many lives about you?
Yeah, big photoshopping. Yeah. No, but it's like this idea of different selves and the way that he will act even in a fashion shoot and become a persona that isn't him. But it's really interesting, this character construction.
I've been absolutely fascinated with that. And I think if I wasn't such a chicken, I might have tried to be an actor. But I think, that... manifestation that creating this, so the understanding of character, the understanding of how people are reading us and then manifesting that, then kind of creating that in real time is and we all do it. We all, how we code switch, and do all sorts of things. I just find it absolutely fascinating and addictive. I mean, I got totally obsessed with this, the idea of body language, I think when I was about 18 19. I bought a book on body because I knew that I was being looked at in a certain way, and yet I felt a totally different way. So I was being like kind of perceived in a way for what I was wearing, or, because I'm not an idiot, and despite what people say. And but I knew that, when I would recognize that, this person has just moved away from me because they thought I was going to do something, or I might do something. I'm
like, here I am, like hoodie.
Yeah, like, and yet I'm like, the least likely person to do anything. It's like that kind of dichotomy in your mind. It's like, but maybe I am like this. And so I was just really interested.
It's funny how you can recognize that in someone else's perception of you. I've had that experience myself where I felt like someone's felt threatened by my presence or somewhere, and I'm always like, no, darling, you've really not got to worry.
Which almost makes it worse, probably.
Yeah, and then you're like, I'm not going to do anything. I've really...
That agitation is probably making the situation.
Well, there's this thing, there's these memes going around, like gay men, when they're walking, there's a woman walking on their own and the gay man's walking behind them. They want to sort of shout out and go, I'm gay, it's okay, I'm not a threat. Don't feel like, because you feel this like responsibility.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite a horrible feeling like someone else is threatened by you or intimidated by you.
I mean, and absolutely, I would hate also to go around the world, live my life having to, or feeling threatened by people, being in that vulnerable position. So I understand the other side, and it's no kind of judgment necessarily on that, but it's more just in terms of recognizing these different experiences, so the different kind of way that someone sees us, sees people in the world, and the way that we as individuals feel about ourselves.
But also, if you think about America, like that becomes incredibly dangerous because
then
there's people, who get shot and killed, and do you know what I mean?
Well,
because of those
profile.
Social structures.
Sorry, I was talking more about women walking the street feeling.
Oh yes,
yeah.
I see what
particularly
you mean.
Vulnerable.
No, that's different.
I don't mean police officers who have kind of fed themselves on a diet of racism and all sorts of things and justified
been enabled with
That's totally.
And what I was thinking about when you talked about gestures, so this idea of like putting your hands in your pockets, how that then becomes a sign for those police to be able to shoot or act, or it becomes this whole language,
reaching
doesn't
for
it?
A weapon,
it's
just, or
well, it's a total cover, isn't it? I mean, it's a nonsense. It's so dark. I'm laughing because it's just so disturbing that it can be used, and because they know exactly how they can use. He went for something. I thought he was gonna, all you have to have the belief that something was gonna happen, and that's
yeah,
justified.
To like that,
that's justified.
Yeah,
but I'm not a lawyer, but I don't want to get too deep into that, but I just do. It is about an awareness, and I think I've probably spoken before, but my work is about trying to create an awareness of oneself, an awareness of one's own internal state, but then also the mechanisms, the learnings, that create that, and that also, so which then impact on other people. And, because I am so kind of fascinated by, why do I think that? Why did I feel that? Or why do I, and I guess it's an inquisitiveness to kind of poke the other person. I guess my artwork's almost like trying to poke the other person.
Yeah,
go, what do you think?
Yeah.
And, they've been described as booby traps before, like...
Have they?
In the sense that, you have these things which look like they could be a classical sculpture, or they're done in a particular way, which, looks seductive. And then before you know, I said before the small pieces, you're face to face with a question or a proposition or a sort of inquisitive thing about what are you looking at? What do you think you're looking at? You know, and then people feel vulnerable. They're like, oh shit, you know.
Maybe that's the essence of what art is, though, and has the potential to be, you know.
It doesn't have to do, because otherwise then it's just decoration. And it's just like, oh, that's pleasing to the eye done.
I totally agree with you. For me, it's about creating work which makes us uncomfortable, which asks questions, which sort of expand our understandings and increases the depth of our knowledge.
Certainly they're powerful, they're uncomfortable, but they're also powerful and they're incredibly beautiful.
Thank you.
And in the kind of the walking around and being amongst them feels really rewarding and special.
There is a kind of calmness almost, 100%. Which I mean, I haven't even been there yet to see one yet, unfortunately, but I feel calm sometimes when I see them. There is a kind of serenity in
100%.
I think that partly is because of the scale for the public works, is that, you know, I talked about an element of vulnerability within the works, but I think the scale sort of belies that. You don't feel worried or concerned for these individuals because they're 9 foot tall.
Yeah.
You know? So they can have vulnerable poses or not have the puffed out chests or the...
Wow, that's really interesting. Sorry to jump in there. So because they're taller, you don't feel like they're vulnerable in some ways. But imagine if you had them and they were like 1 foot tall in the public domain.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
No, but so that's what I use with the works that go inside.
Yeah.
You know, it's about understanding the environments that these works will be seen in and about the likely impact that psychological impact that will have on anyone who sees the works. And so, you know, the kind of smaller pieces I do, people do, they feel more care towards them.
Yeah. But imagine if that was in the public domain. If you had like a 3 foot or a 1 foot figure just there on the street.
For me, it would certainly be very different.
Yeah.
And I think it would be a really significant shift in the attitude that someone has when they see that work.
Yeah.
And I think it would, because it goes so against what we expect to see.
Yeah.
So in terms of public work, Tracy Emin did the small bird, didn't she?
Yes. And she did in Australia a load of birds.
She did children's clothing as well, like a little lost shoe
tiny little shoes.
And then very bronze and then clever interactions in terms of scale of public works, but also they retain the scale of what we expect to see.
Mm.
So if you see a 1 foot tall person, you know, in as a sculpture, it creates more of a curiosity perhaps than seeing a 9 foot kind of figure, because we are used to seeing large sculptures of people.
Mm.
It's just how they're presented and who they represent.
Mm. Yeah, so you want to be part of that.
So I
want to
use that understanding
to
disrupt the expectations, to disrupt that learning.
Whereas a small sculpture might become too novelty.
I think it would draw people down a different path, which I think, you know, could be used very cleverly.
Mm.
But for me, I guess I'm engaging with this conversation of what we expect to see.
Interesting.
In a very particular way and disrupting that and saying, but, you know, but why did you expect that? And now how does this feel? And what are you thinking now?
Interesting.
You saying about how you might have been an actor on a different
terrible actor.
You first started when you was at Chelsea. Was it after Chelsea with your MA or the Royal College of Art? And you made a video of yourself called Lick, which actually I suddenly thought in COVID times that would be really, really
pretty provocative.
Outrageous. But this is a video of you licking a whole gallery space.
Yeah. That was at Chelsea. Yeah, I was doing my BA.
Yeah.
And it was a work which was, I've always been massively into the idea of the unconscious and how we process information without being aware of it and how that impacts our conscious experiences. And so this work was about, called Licked, was about the sort of the idea of coating a gallery space in a layer of invisible saliva. And would that kind of, with pheromones or some sort of chemical, biological kind of element, connect to a viewer to give them a sense that there's a something else here, there's someone here who I feel something, and would they take that away with them? And it was also an element of the performative, so would it create this sort of buzz that people would witness this idiot sort of licking a space and then go away and the rumor would continue, and so it was about this kind of two parallel things happening. About an hour in, I remember the first time I put my tongue to the wall, it just absolutely stuck to it because the wall was always so dry. So I had
Oh my God.
So I slightly adapted the technique and I got a flannel and lots of chewing gum. and a little bowl of water to try and lubricate this wall. But basically, you know, it's going through putting my hands up onto the wall as a frame, as a reference point, so I knew where I was. Because it sounds weird, but you know, until you put your face to a wall, you don't realise how big the wall is. But very quickly, I thought this wall was getting dirty, dirtier and dirtier. And it, then suddenly I realised that it was my tongue that was starting to bleed.
No.
And so this kind of very kind of this conceptual work, which had me as the artist sort of almost like, you know, with a one up on the viewer in terms of like knowing what's happened here, but do you realize it, that dynamic shifted like 180 to the viewer, you know, watching me get into all these awkward positions to try and cover the walls with my tongue, but then bleeding onto it. So it became a very visual thing. And then it became this visual record of basically an individual's efforts to try and cover the walls. And so there's this effort essentially to connect to people. To like,
but it's your interior as well. It's like your inside. Yeah, exactly. That's your, that's very visceral, isn't it?
And the smell in the room with the blood and then the, you know, the colouring.
Really?
Yeah, it was, and the drips. And people thought I'd faked it and that I was using dye or paint or something. But no, it was...
How long did the recovery from that take?
I'm still recovering.
Yeah.
Mentally, I'm still recovering.
Trying to grow your tongue back.
Grafts.
Wow.
It was, but I did it for 3 days. Wow. And it's interesting. I look at the... So it wasn't supposed to be a video work. I did record it.
How long did it take, sorry, to lick the whole...
3 days.
3 days? Yeah. And what, you'd go home, sleep?
I'd go home, sleep, come back
gargle,
in.
Gargle, Listerine,
yeah, basically, yeah. Salt water.
And I bet the second day you were like, why the fuck have I done this?
Second day was was like, what am I doing? And having to jump into that psychological mode of you know, I'm going to do this. Of course I'm going to do this. And this is important. And
it's grueling, though.
Do you think
isn't
as
it?
An age, like, that's like, you would never do that now?
I would never do that. I don't think I'd be able to do that now, to be honest. Yeah. Is this something?
Well, wouldn't,
that,
I mean, people would go like COVID, right? Yeah, there, yeah, right, like, right. That's so radical.
Yeah, but even the physical demand.
Yeah.
Like, it's quite a grueling
it
thing.
Was,
like,
that's a young man's work.
I look at the video now, I'm like, oh, that slim bastard. I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't be able to knowingly go into that position and do it. Like, so many things, like when I was first, did the first bronze sculptures, the nudes, I was spending over like 24 hours doing those in one go to get them ready in time to show in Chicago. And, you know, if I couldn't knowingly go into that position, that situation, that was really grueling. Like, I think I had to take to bed for a few days after I finished 5 of them because my feet were messed up.
Wow.
Just standing up for so long. But with the lick piece, yeah, you know, I look at that and I kind of wish I could do that again, because I think it's a work that could function different places. But I think that for me, it's the video footage that exists now as the work, and that idea exists as the work. And you know, I'd love to show it properly as a
museum show.
As a museum show.
Retrospective.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's
powerful. It's really dynamic. And
I just think that, you know, it's not like I can...
And gross. It's kind of gross, Thomas. You know, that's all your gold all over the wall. Yeah. I mean, the people who came in afterwards to clean that up must have been like, what?
So I had to repaint it.
Was that part of the deal?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I had to get it repainted, but the blood, it just came through.
Oh, my God.
So it had to be boarded over.
Plasterboarded over, so your blood's behind there.
Behind there, yeah. But it was at Chelsea.
It's been 100 years
so I think they've knocked it down now, I think.
Oh, like,
probably
God.
Probably luxury flats on Manresa Road.
It's a fascinating work, though, on a level of, like, the body in space as well.
Yeah.
You know, on so many levels, that's a really fascinating artwork.
Yeah.
Like, it's impressive.
What's next for you? What's going on?
Oh, so, well, we've got the Windrush.
Yeah, so when is that
commission?
Yeah. It's 2021, isn't it?
So,
with Veronica Ryan, you're sharing
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fantastic artist, Veronica Ryan, who's making pieces that will go also in Hackney.
If people go online, they can see what this image is going to be, what the work's
going to be. Well, the work's... So basically, they can get an understanding of the kind of thing it will be. It will be, you know, large bronze figure or figures. We're now looking to have the launch on Windrush Day in 22.
Mm-hmm.
On Windrush Day in 21, we're looking to have an exhibition which is going to sort of showcase some of the people who have been involved in the process of creating these figures.
Great.
So that's really exciting. I got lots of other...
Is it good to have a commission? Is that like a really rewarding experience?
It's an interesting experience because it feels very official. You know, like, I'm used to making... I make work that interests me and that's, you know, tied into all the other questions I've been asking myself throughout the years. And then when someone says, we want that, you know, we want that, but for us, and it becomes this sort of conversation, which is kind of challenging in terms of the expectations, you know, like predetermining what you're going to do is quite interesting as an artist. But it's just, I just think in terms of what it will be, and like, or for, you know, for Hackney and for, you know, the Windrush, celebrating the Windrush generation and the impact and the contribution that's been made to British society, you know, that's a huge honour. Which,
and the treatment that they, that,
oh, yeah,
if, like the, you know, the politics of it all, I mean,
still
it's
happening.
Just, yeah,
got flights going off to Jamaica. It's just
horrific. It's the fact that that's ongoing, and the way that they were treated, that
it's just
generation,
incredibly heartless. It's appalling, yeah. I, even on a political level, I just don't understand it. There's you know, you think about all the other allowances that are made, and then you've got people who've been paying their taxes and contributing for their whole lives, who are just, you know, just straight up good people. So at any point, they should just be like, even if they want to say, legally speaking, if they want to use, okay, whatever, but morally speaking, ethically speaking, be human. Look at these people, the lives they are living, what you're doing to their lives, and just have some compassion. You know, that, I just find it unbelievable, to be honest. Unbelievable.
So that exhibition is going to be 22nd of June then?
Yes, 22nd of June. Yep.
It'll be 2021 and 2022.
Yes.
So it's going to be like an extended kind of
doubling
project.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I feel incredibly grateful to have the opportunity to kind of like have that contact, to also get to know more about Windrush and generation, because it's obviously, well,
is it an educational centre they're going to set up as well then, or?
Oh, there might be, I don't know.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
Alongside like literature and, you know, stories and everything.
That's meeting, the other great part of the work, isn't it? Is that you're going to educate other people too.
It would be not quite nice to have like a whole,
I hope it will create awareness, because there's a lot of people in the UK, like, I've talked about Windrush, and go, oh, Windrush, what's that?
I know, the ignorance is like pretty shocking.
Well, you know, if we look at how things are taught in the UK, we talk about, you know, Black History Month. It's like, well, a month. It should be integrated into our understanding of what's happened in the UK. Like, there's so
already
many different.
Then that's other.
Yeah,
that's
other. Oh, we'll give you a month. And it's ridiculous, and it's really upsetting and a bit disturbing that that is still in 2020, going to 21. That is still the attitude, the accepted understanding is that we give you a month and then you do some special things and then we go back to the real history. The idea of real history, you know, like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's shocking. Yeah, what else then? So you got the commission?
I've just gone all blank. I've got the commission. I've got lots of projects I'm working towards, lots of secret things.
Oh, secret squirrels.
Russell loves secrets. He wants to expose all the secrets.
Yeah, I'm gonna stay still on this one.
Okay. Because
until things are, you know, in black and white, concrete, but I'm really just pushing forward on, you know, new bodies of work, and really looking forward to 21 and hopefully showing some more public things,
but
also developing a whole series of paintings which tap into the sort of the original ideas of the animations I was working on, and how we exhibit what we're thinking via the eyes and how we look at each other and look at
these
things.
These are great. I saw these in the studio.
Well, I really want to come to the studio. So
you come. Yeah, yeah.
That's what's next for you.
Open invite.
Rob's
coming to
the studio.
I've got
the commission. Rob's coming to my studio.
So,
it's really big.
Thomas, we ask every guest two questions. One is, if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork, or it could be a public sculpture, or it could be a building, or anything you want, we will help you. We will bring a truck. We will bring cranes.
Oh,
we'll do anything you want.
Yes, we'll wrap it.
What would you take home?
Oh my goodness. I feel like the British Museum's got everything. maybe something before they got there. well, you see that guy, he's gone in. Is he French? And he's taken some of the I'm not sure which country, but something from Africa. He took it off the stand and tried to walk out of it and got arrested. So maybe something like that. Maybe one of the Bennings or something from the British Museum.
Mm-hmm.
What are those? What's the Bennings?
Amazing. Are they bronzes or are they just brass? There's these panels which have figures, sort of, they're like relief panels of these incredibly just beautiful figures. These, I think they're royal figures. I'm going to get done for like my lack of art history here. But I just remember going to the British Museum with my mum and going down to the dubiously dark African basement. You know, I don't know why they do that. Why can't they take it up to like where they have the classical Greek stuff? But and looking at these truly beautiful arrangement of panels, reliefs of figures, and just, I don't know, it's like magical, you know. It's so
you want them for yourself, or you want to return them?
I think I would take them to return them, but I might take the long route,
like a mold, maybe. Yeah.
Well, I'll just take the long route around.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, travel. If I could get, if you guys could get me like a nice train or something, and or a ship, or I could have them up on the wall.
So you want to go on a cruise? You want to cruise?
I just want to cruise.
Do you want to take these? You want
us to put
you on a cruise? You can live with the work, and then you can.
I mean, there's so many things out there. I don't know. Like, you know, before, you know, a lot of the troubles happened in Egypt, I really want to go and see the pyramids, just because I know it sounds like a cliche, but in terms of trying to get a real world experience with the scale.
Yeah, the oldest architecture.
And also the Benin bronzes, they've got over 900 of them at the British Museum.
Yeah, nice.
They wouldn't even notice if you took them.
No, we should take all 900.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll take them all back.
Heavy. That's heavy, though.
No, but it's...
No, because if you get back there, they'll say that you missed a couple, and then we'll have to go all the way back.
Yeah. Back and forth.
You know, I think because a lot of, with the Newman heads, you know, these aluminium heads I've been working with, they are definitely influenced by ancient Egyptian representations of deities their leaders, and I would love to kind of check those out.
But staring straight ahead comes from the Egyptian sculptures, doesn't it? Like the gazing into eternity. Yeah, that's what all the sarcophaguses had, and
I love that stance. But maybe
your work at the beginning had a lot of, but you still do that. But you have a lot of characters who do stare into.
Yeah, they do. So actually, it moved towards the kind of that forward gaze with the open eye socket. Kind of things, the open pupils. That, you know, that the viewer kind of feels that last moment of psychological sort of awareness, I guess. But the initial smaller pieces were a lot more exaggerated in terms of their expression. So they're a bit more like freeze frames in a moment where someone might be biting a lip or looking to one direction. Because I felt with the smaller scale, they were able to retain this kind of idea of motion without it becoming disturbing or overwhelming. And then as the figures start to get larger, or the heads got larger, I wanted to really work with how, I guess, formally the they balance themselves. You know, how they balance themselves in our minds. So I felt like these, it's like cinema versus TV, you know, the size of the gesture changes and the impact changes.
Yeah.
And so I wanted I had to make it more cinematic perhaps and kind of pare down the gestures, refine the gestures, and because knowing that the impact would be larger.
Right.
I didn't really answer your question, did I? No. I think I would like to steal more contemporary work because I feel like, you know.
But you look more to classical, like antique historical sculpture as inspiration rather than contemporary sculptors,
I have to be honest, I do. Because I think that I mix that kind of classical and the, you know, whichever country you want to talk about, with basically the contemporary experience I have. So, you know, like these coloured bases for like the bronze heads from cars, you know, because I was looking at how plinths, status, cars, status, you know, like matching them together, so bringing the contemporary into, you know, inverted commas, classical. I like kind of fragrances and stuff like that. So the licked piece was actually because I was fascinated with fragrance, and I was really interested in how smell has such a huge psychological impact on us. And so basically anything I have as a hobby or as a you know I enjoy ends up in the work, and becomes consumed by the work, and I have to find another one, and then, so it's like this endless pursuit. So I don't know. I think if I could get away with it, I'd probably, nick a Kerry James Marshall, I think, actually.
Yeah?
Really? Yeah.
I'll never be able to afford one. But
have you met him before?
I have. He's absolutely amazing guy. He's such a lovely man. Yeah. And just very generous with his time and his thoughts. And it was, you know, they say don't meet your heroes, but...
That was a good one.
Yeah. I didn't even know he was my hero until I met him.
Oh. All right. And the other question is, what is your favourite colour?
Oh, dear. I used to only wear blue.
What, blew everything?
Blew everything, yeah.
Did you know why you did that, or...?
Laziness.
Right.
This
is double denim we're talking about, like, bewitched style, or...?
Oh my God, I'm just checking, did I do double denim? I think 2001 I might have cracked out the double denim.
We've all done double denim at some point.
Britney and Justin. Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake rocked it, didn't
they? I did double corduroy the other day, I'm not sure.
Double corduroy? I do double corduroy.
Okay, that's good.
I love double corduroy.
Right. I wasn't sure.
Oh, all right, ladies.
I stepped out that door. You know what? There's the Azura blue, or the kind of sapphire blue.
Yeah?
Oh yeah.
It's hard, blue is such a inspiring, comforting, psychological effect color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I choose all the colored bases for these heads to try and balance out the different kind of feelings I get from the heads themselves. And I think blue is one I could sustain and just stare at. You know, red, I painted a bedroom bright orange once. It drove me mad. So, you know, red.
That's orange.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Have you used blue in your work? Have you used it on bases?
I use blue quite a lot for prep drawings, and the new painting series I'm doing are going to be using a lot of blue.
Right.
And I know that it's been used before, but I think it's been used before for a reason, and it's because it's so powerful, and it communicates in a lot of different ways. So I think, you know, it's the sea, it's the sky, what is it? Depends on what kind of blue.
Yes.
I like the fact that you can shift the slight hues of it and have massive differences in how it comes across and how it feels.
Yeah.
And how those colours can, or those hues can play, and the shades can play, and the translucencies. You know, getting carried away.
No. I'm a blue fan.
Yeah.
You know, going back to the thing about scent, I've just got this thing in my brain right now, but there's this amazing little sort of magazine. It's like a really small little publication, maybe like 30, 40 pages. And it's a woman who's, she makes perfume, so she's a nose. And she documents little stories of relationships she's had. And then at the beginning of each one, there's a kind of scratch and sniff bit of the page where you get to smell the scent that reminds her of them. And because she's a perfect, she looks at the world through smell.
Yeah.
I really want to find it, because honestly, it's an amazing,
like,
I got one for Thilo Heinzmann and he loved it. It's such an, it sounds a bit weird, but it's an amazing book. It's so, so cool. And I think you'd find it really fascinating, because it's a psychological
sniff of your life. So it's, if I was to scratch and sniff you, what would it smell like?
Babes, I don't know. I've got that the fragrance that always comes to is Frederick Malle's French Lover.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
you're a French Lover.
Angelica reed, Angelica seed based.
Yes.
On it.
Yeah. He knows.
I told you I'm a fragrance man.
He knows.
You guys
fragrance.
Wear cord, double cord. Yeah. You both know.
But I like Frederick.
You understand?
I like Frederick.
You're allowed in. Yeah.
I like Frederick Malle.
Made it to boot camp.
I like Frederick Malle before he got sold or whatever.
When did that
I think
happen?
About 2 years ago.
Yeah, me
but too. I was wearing the fragrance before that. And also Dries Van Noten's fragrance, the one that he made, which has like vanilla and croissants and kind of all these
Croissant.
Kind of, yeah, it's got all these really
Croissant.
Yeah, but there were smells that remind him of like family, I think, and growing up or something. I loved his a really weird fragrance, that one, but I really loved the story behind that one. I'm going to find that book for you and send
Please,
it to you.
It's
really
amazing.
Weird because it's about psychology as well, so it's about the psychology of smells in the relationship. It's really interesting.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Well, Thomas J. Price.
It's been the dream.
It's been so nice doing it in person. Like, you know, here, we've been doing them all remotely for so long now. It's so wonderful to...
No, it feels good.
...be in the
room. No more webcams.
Yeah, zoom out the window. But for everyone listening, everyone will be talking about the images on images on our Instagram at TalkArt, and you're on Instagram.
I am indeed.
What's your handle? TBG.
TP Studio.
TP Studio.
I didn't think it through.
That's good, though. At TP Studio. And we'll be back again next week, right?
We'll be back very soon.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks
Thank you, Thomas.
Cheers,
we love
Thomas.
You. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.